by John Shea.
The former US President Donald Trump has been the target of an assassination attempt. He was speaking at a Republican campaign rally in Pennsylvania when a gunman fired shots from the roof of a nearby building. Mr. Trump was seen with blood coming from his right ear. He defiantly pumped his fist in the air repeatedly, saying, "Fight, fight," before being escorted off stage by Secret Service agents. One person in the crowd died, while two others are in a critical condition. Officials say Mr. Trump is doing well and has left hospital. The attacker was shot dead by the Secret Service. President Biden has condemned the incident, saying it had no place in America. World leaders have expressed their shock at the assassination attempt. Sir Keir Starmer said he was appalled, while the French President Emmanuel Macron called it a tragedy for our democracies. Ukraine's leader Volodymyr Zelensky said he hoped America could emerge stronger from the attack. In other news, the government's advisor on political violence has written to the Home Secretary Yvette Cooper calling for an investigation into the intimidation of parliamentary candidates during the general election. Lord Walney said he believed there'd been a concerted campaign by extremists to create a hostile atmosphere. Sir Keir Starmer says securing economic growth will be at the centre of his government's legislative agenda. It'll be announced in the King's speech on Wednesday and will include more than 35 new bills. There'll be measures to create a state-owned green energy investment company and to give more powers to local government. Tens of thousands of football fans are in Berlin for the men's Euros final between England and Spain. A win for the Three Lions would see them take home their first major men's trophy in almost 60 years. Spain have won the competition three times before, most recently in 2012. And the Princess of Wales will present the trophy to the winner of the Wimbledon men's tennis final this afternoon, in only her second public engagement since announcing her cancer diagnosis. Novak Djokovic will attempt to secure an eighth Wimbledon title when he takes on the defending champion Carlos Alcaraz. And the weather. Most of the UK will be cloudy with some light showers. There'll be sunnier spells for northwest Scotland this afternoon. Tonight will become dry, with southern areas clearing up. And that's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3, just after 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for this week's edition of Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The director, Clio Barnard, won prizes and critical acclaim for her first feature film, The Arbour. It blended fact and fiction to depict the short, troubled life of the brilliant Bradford playwright Andrea Dunbar. Since then, she's taken on a wide range of British stories. She directed Claire Danes and Tom Hiddleston in The Essex Serpent, a six-part adaptation of the best-selling book by Sarah Perry. She returned to Bradford for Ali and Ava, a love story which won a BAFTA nomination for Outstanding British Film, and for The Selfish Giant, the tale of two children trying to make money from selling scrap metal. Music often plays an important part in your films, Clio, and you've brought us Alice Coltrane, Bieber, Philip Glass. But to begin, Bach. Why?
There's a film that I absolutely love by Pasolini called Gospel According to St. Matthew, and it actually has a really eclectic soundtrack. So there's Odetta and Blind Willie Johnson and a Congolese Mass and lots of Bach, including the St. Matthew Passion. I absolutely love the film. He was a Marxist and an atheist, so it was, in a way, quite a strange choice for him to make the Gospel According to St. Matthew. But he set it in the south of Italy, and he cast non-actors. And in some ways, that in itself seems to me to be some kind of political statement. And really, you see these fantastic portraits of people from the 1960s in the south of Italy. And the music in it is just captivating and beautiful. And it kind of functions in a slightly different way to other films in that you go with it. It's not so much about following the story. It's more about looking at these portraits and listening to this beautiful, eclectic mix of music.
The bit you've chosen is not actually from the St Matthew Passion, is it?
No, I thought, because that's quite familiar to people, I chose the Mass in B minor instead.
And this is the Dona Nobis Pace, Give Us Peace. Dona Nobis Pacem, the conclusion of the Bach Mass in B minor, performed by the Amsterdam Baroque Choir and Orchestra, conducted by Ton Koopman. There's something inexorable about the way those lines unfold. It's almost like a tapestry in which every thread is in the perfect place, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's beautiful. And I guess seeing that alongside neo-realist Italian cinema is something of a contrast that, I don't know, kind of creates another layer of meaning or something.
Tell us a little bit about your early life, Cléo Barnard, because you grew up in Otley in Yorkshire.
I grew up near Otley, yeah. I grew up right on the edge of the moors and went to school in Otley. That landscape is really important to me, and we'll come to some choices that relate to that later.
Of course, Turner was inspired by the hills around there.
He was, yeah, he was.
And your father was an English literature university lecturer.
Yeah, he was lecturer, then professor at Leeds University of Literature, and he's a Keats scholar. And he raised me and my siblings in Yorkshire. And my mum met my stepfather when I was about seven and moved to London to be with him. And he's a jazz composer.
Mike Westbrook.
That's right.
Yeah. And your mum, Kate, is a jazz singer.
Yes.
Do you remember hearing your mum sing when you were young?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I remember singing lullabies, actually, and singing folk songs when I was really small, singing me to sleep.
You were about seven when they divorced.
Yeah,
right.
Around
a
there.
Difficult time to come to terms with something like that.
It was very difficult, yeah. Mm. Yeah, it was. Yeah, I don't quite know what to say beyond that, other than, you know, I have a good relationship with both of my parents, difficult though it was.
And you were brought up by your dad, and I think your next choice comes rather from his record collection.
It does, yeah. He had a fantastic record collection, actually, and I'm slightly ashamed to say that I didn't really dig into all the classical music that he had. I was sort of more interested in Bob Dylan or the Beatles or the Rolling Stones. And I guess he was influenced by the folk revival in the 60s in terms of some of his choices of music. And one point he was away and me and my siblings had a house party, which I don't think we should have been having. And we were playing lots of music, post-punk, kind of everybody jumping around. And a friend who clearly had much better taste than me put on Lead Belly, which kind of brought the dance floor to a standstill. But yeah, I was really kind of taken aback by this brilliant music, and from that really developed a love of blues and folk, I guess.
It's got a very raw quality, hasn't it?
Yeah, incredibly raw quality, which I absolutely love.
Where Did You Sleep Last Night, performed by the American folk and blues singer Lead Belly. As well as singing, Clio, your mum taught art in Leeds, so I wonder whether she got you painting and drawing from an early age.
Yeah, I did love painting and drawing, actually, and at school that was kind of the thing that I wanted to do all of the time. At a certain point, I started going to Jacob Cramer Art College in Leeds after school. They ran these kind of evening things to, I guess, encourage kids from schools to go and do a foundation course there. And it kind of opened something up for me in that it was taught in a very different way from the way it was taught in school. There was a combination of freedom and discipline that I absolutely loved. So there was a kind of real rigour of life drawing or of certain exercises that we'd be set. And it wasn't really about the outcome. It was about the process and being incredibly rigorous and finding a freedom within that, I suppose. And yeah, I think at that point I lost all interest in school and just knew that's where I wanted to go and doing that course.
Very interesting, given the films you then went on to make, those qualities that attracted you to the visual arts at that point.
Yeah, and as we said, my stepfather, Mike Westbrook, is a composer, jazz composer, and there's a mixture in that, I think, of discipline, rigour and freedom. I hadn't really thought about that until I started thinking about the kind of music choices I was making and how much I loved being at art school and those two things rubbing up against each other, I suppose. And yeah, now you come to mention it, I can see it, maybe particularly in The Arbour, actually, that there's the discipline of the actors lip-syncing to the voices that I'd gathered in interview, and then something about the moment of performance that they have to be absolutely there, able to perform at the same time as doing this very difficult technique.
Did you have an interest in film at this point? Were you looking at film?
There were two films, I would say, that I saw around that time that made a very marked impression on me. And one was Performance by Nick Rogue, which I watched when I was probably far too young. But when I was a teenager, you know, these films were shown on telly kind of late at night. So I watched that and that made a really strong impression on me because it's a remarkable film. And it was kind of the bit where you go inside Mick Jagger's head and this mixing of identities. I could see that a film could do something to you. And then the other film that had a really marked impression was Rashomon by Kurosawa.
Well, your next piece comes from that.
Well, the score just takes me right back into the depths of it, I suppose. And it's a very thought-provoking film structured around a court case, a hearing. So people are giving testimony, and these four different testimonies that are told from four different points of view. But when you go into their accounts of what they say happened, the music takes over and it's visual and visceral, and it's no longer about words in a way.
Actually, the composer, Fumio Hayasaka, had a very close relationship, I think, with Akira Kurosawa. I mean, extraordinarily close, and I know that the director felt inspired by the composer, which was an interesting, slight reversal of what sometimes happens.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a very exciting way to work to me, and I haven't done it, but I would love to. I think I came somewhere close to it, possibly, with the latest project that I just did, which was Sherwood, which was a returning series, so it already had a score by Lorne Balfe, and he delivered his reimagining of the score for series two before we started shooting. And that was fantastic, actually.
Well, let's hear some of the soundtrack of Rashomon.
Thank you.
Does it bring it back?
It does bring it back, yeah.
The film suite from the soundtrack of the 1950 film Rashomon, directed by Akira Kurosawa and composed by Fumio Hayasaka. Interestingly, in his autobiography, Kurosawa said that working with Hayasaka completely changed his views on how film music should be used and made him view music, which I really like this, as a counterpoint to the image and not just an accompaniment. Is that something that you would aspire to?
Yes, 100%. Yeah, in some ways it needs to be doing something separate, doing its own thing, and I never want it to tell anybody how they should be feeling. It can completely change something if you run something counter to what you're saying.
Do you have a preconception of what the music should be? On those occasions when I've worked with a director, they have the same problem we have in this programme, really, is that they're trying to put in words something that is an abstract language, and the only thing that really does it justice is to hear it. So do you talk to people about the kind of thing you hear in your head beforehand?
I would say that it is a real problem, and I wish I had the language to speak about it, because I don't. In some ways, I have to hear it. And what I've done with Harry Escott, who's composed the scores for my films, is going and being with him and spending time with him, looking at the picture. And the scores that Harry's done have been very minimal, because I haven't wanted to tell an audience how to feel. He calls it stealth composing, because it's there and it's very important. Like, it's doing an enormous amount, but it's very subtle. And on The Arbor and The Self-Giant and on Alien Ava, he worked very closely with the sound designer, Tim Barker. So Tim would give him sounds of electricity, for example, and then Harry would compose tones. And they're doing an enormous amount of work, but that you're not really conscious of in supporting or lifting or holding. And then usually at the beginning and the end of the film, Harry can fly.
But meanwhile, there can be an element of mutual improvisation.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he can play something and say, what do you think of this? And you could say, I think it should be a bit lower or a bit more muted or whatever.
Yeah, I'm sure it's deeply frustrating for Harry. Deeply. So quite often we have to just sit and listen and play around with things. It's been quite different doing The Essex Serpent and Sherwood, because they're not my authored work, in a sense. It's given me, in some ways, a freedom to play with score in a way that I haven't with my own work. And, yeah, that's been fascinating.
And do you recall hearing your stepfather, Mike Westbrook, playing and obviously improvising, which is what made me think of that?
Yes, yes. I remember the sound of him playing the piano at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I mean, I think that was a real habit for him, that every day he'd get up early and he'd play the piano. Yeah, it was really beautiful. And as a quite small child, I'd land in London, meet with my siblings, we'd get picked up by a roadie, taken to somewhere where they were rehearsing or possibly playing. And long improvisations. I remember watching this very long, this wasn't Mike playing, this was a drummer called Dave Barry, and kind of finding a way to appreciate it, I suppose, or get lost in it. And partly it was about the physicality of watching him drum and watching what was going on for him, and how, I guess it was that thing about discipline and freedom again, of him understanding what would happen if he hit this and he hit that, and really getting lost in it. I loved it, actually.
Well, this next music by Mike Westbrook was inspired by William Blake.
Yes, and I think that was something else as a small child, was knowing Blake's poems as songs, which is apparently how Blake intended them to be heard, songs of innocence and experience. And perhaps for me as a small child, this was also more accessible in a way. I love the descriptions. I love the words, the colours.
So what exactly have you chosen from this?
I've chosen a song called I See Thy Form, with Phil Minton singing. My mum is also singing. And, yeah, I guess it became one of his best known or best loved works, and they've performed it many, many times. And I can see why, if you were introduced to Blake, you'd become obsessed with him.
I see thy form, O lovely, mild Jerusalem, winged with six wings, in the capacious bosom of the sleeper. Lovely threefold, in head and heart and reins, three universes of love and beauty. Thy forehead bright, of pearl, reflect eternity. Beneath thy azure wings of feathery down, ribbed, delicate, and clothed with feathered gold and azure and purple from thy white shoulders, shadowing purity and holiness, feathered with soft crimson of the ruby, bright as fire, spreading into azure wings, which like a canopy. Bends over thy immortal head, and in which eternity dwells.
I See Thy Form, recorded live at Toynbee Hall in East London, composed and performed by Mike Westbrook on the piano, with Phil Minton singing, and with the London College of Music Chamber Choir, directed by Paul Ayres, and the violinist was Billy Thompson. Clara Barnard, what sort of work were you making when you were an art student?
I was doing a lot of drawing with charcoal, and I was making records of my drawings as they changed, because I was more interested in the way they changed than trying to reach a final finished thing in a way. So I studied fine art in Newcastle, and they had these Bolex cameras, little hand-wound cameras that would take 100-foot spools of black and white film. So I'd set it up in front of the drawing and click, click, click as I drew. And I absolutely loved the celluloid, and I loved the process, and I loved the magic, because they had this tiny dark room. So I'd go into the dark room, process an egg, and then put it in a projector and project it. And I just fell in love with it. Everything else I kind of pushed to one side and just started experimenting with film, really, because it just felt like all these different art forms kind of coalesced within this one art form that was film. There was sound, and there was score and image and movement and time. It's just, it felt like it had everything, and therefore in some ways I didn't have to choose.
And you played in a band at the same time, Clio?
I did. I was not a very good musician, but I was the brass section of an art school band in that I had a trumpet and a saxophone. But I was not particularly good at it. I just would join in. But I loved playing, yeah.
Now, the Arbour was released in 2010, as I said, about the playwright Andrea Dunbar. What drew you to this story? How did you come across it? Why did you want to go further with it?
I'd always really loved the work of Alan Clarke, and he'd made a film called Rita, Sue and Bob 2, her play. I didn't really actually know very much about Andrea Dunbar. And then I got curious because I saw Out of Joint Theatre Company had created this piece of verbatim theatre by going back to where Andrea was from 10 years after she had died, about what had changed in those last 10 years. So I read Andrea's work as a play for the first time and wanted to go back and another decade on, really reflect on all those different forms of representation of a very particular place.
It was filmed on Bradford's Buttershaw estate, where Andrea lived until her very early demise at the age of 29. And you intercut with old documentary footage, excerpts of her reenacted plays, interviews with current residents, and there has a very fresh feel about it because you did something quite unusual, didn't you?
Yeah, I interviewed her family and people who knew her, and I recorded audio only. I didn't take a camera with me. I just recorded sound. What I was thinking about was verbatim theatre and how it uses verbatim testimony and how it's always performed on the stage by actors, so there's always going to be a gap between what's represented and the form and how difficult it is, in a way, to represent the real or what we might think of as the truth, I suppose. And stuck to my guns, even though it was quite hard, actually.
Must have been very hard.
It was.
Let's just explain exactly what was going on here. The actors mimed to the original audio you had recorded.
That's right, yeah.
Not easy.
Oh, not easy. Technically not easy at all. Also not easy because people were giving of themselves in terms of these interviews and the ethical responsibility, I suppose, of what you then do with that material. And in some ways, one of the things about that was it actually gave the people who I interviewed a kind of layer of anonymity. I think in some ways they were able to speak more freely. They weren't exposed in a way that they might have been had I taken a camera.
And what do you think you gained from that, other than simply getting the actors to learn their lines, for example? What did you get from the marriage of the original audio and the miming of the actors?
Well, I mean, there were several things. One was that as a viewer, they look at you very directly. I think also you're constantly reminded that you're watching the retelling of a true story and the complication involved in that. So you're constantly asking, who's telling this story? Why are they telling it? You're questioning it. And that feels important to me.
The next piece of music you've chosen had some influence on how you approach this.
Yeah, there's a film by Errol Morris called The Thin Blue Line. And the piece that I've chosen is Philip Glass's score, but with the voices of the people who Errol Morris interviewed. And I'm very taken with the way people speak or the way people tell their stories and the quality of a voice and how stories change.
And what do we see at this point in the film?
Well, part of what Errol Morris did was a series of reconstructions of a crime, someone who was wrongfully convicted of shooting a policeman. And we see that crime reconstructed as different people tell their stories about what happened. And I suppose the way it also relates to Rashomon is that one of the characters in Rashomon says we lie. Sometimes we're not even conscious that we're doing it. We tell our stories as we want to present ourselves, in a way. And
almost as we assume we saw something rather than what we actually saw.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. And the paradox of that is that the film gets to the truth, which is that Randall Adams was not guilty of this murder.
In October, my brother and I left Ohio. We were driving to California. We got into Dallas on a Thursday night. Friday morning, while I'm eating eggs and drinking coffee, I get a good job. I mean, it's, you know, all these people are supposedly out of work. I'm not in town a half a day and I've got a job. It just, everything clicked. It's as if I was meant to be here.
And I'd run away from home a couple times, once or twice, I don't know. And this all started, Dave was running away from home. I took a pistol from my dad's and a shotgun. Took a neighbor's car. They had broken in their house or something and got the keys to it. I forget exactly what it was. Ended up coming to Dallas.
I went to work and no one showed up. Being a weekend, sometimes they worked, sometimes they didn't. On the way home, I ran out of gas. And as I was walking down the street with the gas can, a person at that time pulled over and, you know, I guess since I had the gas can, he figured I was out of gas. I wasn't 100 yards from the car. And being Thanksgiving weekend, there was no gas stations open. So he stopped and asked me if I needed any help.
I'm driving down some street somewhere in Dallas. I just turned 16. And there was a guy over there, I think he ran out of gas. I took him to get some gas. This was Randall Adams. Ended up following him to his room where him and his brother were staying. Eventually that afternoon, we went out and got some beer and what have you, and we smoked a little marijuana and what have you. Went to a movie that night.
I get up, I go to work on Saturday. You know, why did I meet this kid? I don't know. Why did I run out of gas at that time? I don't know. But it happened. It happened.
Well, that was a perfect example of the music not telling you what to expect, but being absolutely the opposite of the sounds we were beginning to hear.
Yeah, it's true. that kind of steadiness with something that is potentially quite melodramatic, I guess, or sensationalist. It's doing the opposite.
Counterpoint.
Yeah, counterpoint.
Prologue by Philip Glass from the original soundtrack of The Thin Blue Line, conducted by Michael Reisman. Although you're exposing the artifice of representation, your films have in fact been lauded for their authenticity and bringing hidden corners of British life to the big screen. Is it important to you, these stories?
Yeah, very important and increasingly important. And really the second film, The Selfish Giant, came out of making The Arbour because of people that I met, and very specifically two boys, two friends, Matty and Michael, who inspired the two boys in The Selfish Giant. And they were either school refusers or excluded from school and were going out scrapping, collecting scrap metal. You know, they weren't the only ones. There were lots of teenage boys in particular who were doing that in Bradford at that time.
And being exploited.
Yeah, being exploited. I think in a way there was such a lack of opportunity there that in some ways it was almost seen as an opportunity.
You decided to use young actors in the film who came from that estate. Did that present difficulties or did they take to it like ducks to water?
I'm smiling because I'm thinking about Sean Thomas and Connor Chapman, who we cast. Yeah, neither of them had acted before. And in some ways they did take to it like ducks to water because both of them had brilliant imaginations and were brilliant storytellers and really had a very natural talent. I do remember one point where Mike Ely, the director of photography, was shooting on an easy rig, like a kind of handheld, and he would move in to find the boys and they would feel like they were getting in his way or something, so they'd move out.
Try and get out of the way.
They'd move out of the way, yeah. So he said, could you just have a word with them? It's them that I'm trying to find. But they're both absolutely brilliant, and Sean is still acting and doing incredibly well, and he was at that time going out on a scrap cart collecting scrap.
But doesn't that tell us something about societies and opportunity or the lack of it, which is presumably behind a lot of your feelings about these films?
Yeah, I think it's true that talent is everywhere, opportunity isn't. Mm-hmm. And I think you see that with Andrea Dunbar, you see that with Connor and Sean and a whole myriad of actors that are pushed to the margins and don't have opportunity or have to fight for opportunity. Yeah.
How did you come across Opaque, your next piece?
I usually have a playlist on the go when I'm making something. It's not about the music that I intend to use in the edit. It's more about evoking a mood or moods. And this was one of the tracks I was listening to a lot, making The Selfish Giant. There's a lot of kind of hinterland, I suppose, in The Selfish Giant. And there's a disused power station in the mist. And there's something of that, I think, evoked in this album.
It's by an Icelandic musician, Hilda Gunnardottir.
Yeah, I came across it and I just absolutely loved it and listened to it slightly obsessively because I just love the way she plays the cello and the sounds she makes.
Thank you. Cake, composed and performed by the Icelandic musician Hildur Guðnadóttir from her 2009 album Without Sinking, and she was joined there by the bass guitarist Skúli Sverrisson. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest this week is the director and writer Clio Barnard. The third, Clio, what's been referred to as your trilogy of films about Bradford, is Ali and Ava, where two people actually really do come together through music.
Yeah, they do, yeah. They have very different musical tastes, and through that difference, they're drawn together.
Ali prefers dance music and Ava country. The film really reveals just how music can literally change your mood and, to a certain extent, your mind. The scene, for example, where they're sofa dancing.
Yeah. In the story, Ava has lots of grandchildren. The kids have pushed the sofa together to make a kind of sofa boat that they can play on. And Ali comes around and he's very excited by this. He has quite a childish disposition or something. And so he wants to play on this sofa boat. So he's kind of jumping around listening to his music and she's listening to her music. And they end up dancing together and it's a very joyful scene.
G. Officer Krupke from West Side Story is your next choice, Clio.
Yeah, it reminds me of Connor and Sean and Matty and Michael, the boys in The Selfish Giant. Their humour, their wit, their intelligence and their understanding that the rest of the world might see them as a problem that needs to be fixed. And there's a kind of brilliant sort of political statement or political anger within the film, but that is sort of reframed as incredibly joyful and incredibly funny. And I remember Sean had us in absolute stitches on the set of The Selfish Giant, the cast and the crew just telling stories from his own life about dealing with the police. I mean, it was kind of like the song. And in some ways, Ali and Ava, I was slightly tongue-in-cheek about this, but is a kind of realist musical insofar as there's a lot of music in the film, but it's all diegetic music. So it's either on the headphones or it's on the radio or she's listening to it on the bus. So Ali and Ava was my musical.
See them cops? They believe everything they read in the papers about us cruddy JDs. So that's what we give them. Something to believe in.
Hey, you!
Who, me, Officer Krupke?
Yeah, you! Give me one good reason for not dragging you down the station house, you punk!
Dear kindly Sergeant Krupke, you gotta understand, it's just our bringing up key that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunks. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks.
Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. Deep down inside us, there is good.
There is good.
There is good. There is good. There is untapped good. Like inside, the worst of us is good.
That's a touching good story.
Let me tell it to the world.
Just tell it to the judge.
Dear kindly judge, your honor, my parents treat me rough with all their marijuana. They won't give me a puff. They didn't want to have me, but somehow I was had. Leap on lizards, that's why I'm so bad.
Right, Officer Krupke, you're really a square. This boy don't need a judge, he needs an analyst care. It's just his neurosis that ought to be quite. He's psychologically destroyed.
I'm destroyed.
We're destroyed. We're destroyed. We're the most destroyed. Like we're psychologically destroyed.
In the opinion of this squad, this child is depraved on account he ain't had a normal home.
Hey, I'm depraved on account I'm deprived.
So take him to a head shrinker. You.
Who, me? Head shrinker.
My daddy beats my mommy clobbers me, my grandpa is a commie, my grandma pushes tea, my sister wears a mustache, my brother wears a dress, goodness gracious, that's why I'm a mess.
Yes, Officer Krupke, he shouldn't be here. This boy don't need a couch, he needs a useful career. Society's played him a terrible trick.
Unsociologically sick.
I am sick.
We are sick. We are sick. We are sick. 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 Like we're sociologically sick.
In my opinion, this child does not need to have his head shrunk at all. Juvenile delinquency is purely a social disease. Hey, I got a social disease. So take him to a social worker.
Which way? Heather.
Dear kindly social worker, they tell me get a job, like be a soda jerker, which means like be a slob. It's not I'm antisocial, I'm only anti-work. Glory, Osby, that's why I'm a jerk.
Officer Kropke, you've done it again. This boy don't need a job, he needs a year in the pen. It ain't just a question of misunderstood. Deep down inside him, he's no good.
I'm no good.
We're no good, we're no good.
The trouble is he drinks.
The trouble is he's crazy.
The trouble is he stinks.
The trouble is he's growing.
The trouble is he's grown.
Grumpy, we got troubles of our own. Officer Grumpy, we're down on our knees.
'Cause no one wants a fella with a social disease.
Officer Grumpy, what are we to do? Chief Officer Grumpy, Grump you!
It's wonderful, isn't it? Yes. I mean, that Sondheim-Bernstein combination really sort of hit gold in that piece.
It really, really did.
You often adapt source material from other writers, don't you? In fact, your film Dark River is inspired by Rose Tremain's novel Trespass, but also a Ted Hughes poem, Remains of Elmet. Any minute now, the last kick in the dark river will fold it away. Why did that line speak to you so strongly, do you think?
I just think it's a beautiful line about letting things go.
Where your previous films perhaps deal with inner city life, this one is really about rural poverty, exploitation of the land and buried secrets. But it avoids romanticism, doesn't it? It's not a pastoral idyll.
It's not. It's a working landscape. Where I grew up, it was very much a working landscape, and there were a lot of tenant farmers. And at that time, tenant farmers had long leases, which is not the case now. You know, they're working class people who live in the countryside, and they were my schoolmates. I guess we were sort of like a new kind of family that had moved into the area or whatever, but that landscape and those issues feel really important to me. It's not a playground. And in some ways, it's about the abuse of the land, I suppose, and commodifying it. The new landlord is the water company. You know, the water companies have been privatised, and I was kind of joked to myself that I do electricity, water, gas.
Well, for the next music, we're going back to a time when there wasn't any electricity or gas. It's 17th century with the Baroque composer and violinist Bieber. Why this?
I just heard it on the radio, on Radio 3, actually, and I just loved it. I just thought it was so beautiful, and it kind of cuts across time. It feels so contemporary.
Passacaglia in G minor for solo violin, composed by Heinrich Ignaz Franz von Bieber and performed by Rachel Podger. Does it still have those marvellous feelings for you?
It does, yeah. I just think it's deeply beautiful, and there's something tragic about it, or sad, but I think sometimes that can really connect us.
Clio Barnard, you're currently working on a film about the country and blues singer Karen Dalton. She was part of the Greenwich Village folk music scene of the 1960s with people like Bob Dylan.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she played with Dylan. There's a photo of her playing with him, but had an extraordinary voice and an extraordinary way of playing. In fact, in Ali and Ava, Ava's listening to a Carol Dalton track when she's dancing on the sofa with Ali. I actually didn't at that point know very much about Karen Dalton's life. I just really loved her music. So, yeah, I went on a research trip. I went to Enid, Oklahoma, where she was born and raised, and New York, and then to Woodstock, where she died, and met various people along the way, including her daughter and musicians who had played with her, people in their 80s.
Because she was only 55 when she died.
She was young. She was very young, yeah. And she died of age-related illnesses.
Karen Dalton is said to have influenced artists like Nick Cave and Joanna Newsom, but she was very reluctant to perform herself, especially her own songs, and often sang covers. Why do you think that was?
I think she had a complicated relationship with her own talent, and she was also quite uncompromising in a good way, I think. She very much wanted to record the albums that she recorded, but one of the myths about her is that she kind of had to be tricked to go into the recording studio. I don't think that's the case. I think she found performing in very intimate settings, she was at her best.
And you've chosen Katie Krull, a traditional Scottish song. The American version of the song is set to date to the Revolutionary War period. Why did you home in on this one?
Because it felt very resonant in a way in terms of what I learnt about her. I chose it partly because it's a traditional song and because of that history, that somebody can reinterpret a song by the way they sing it or the way they play it. She was absolutely loved in the folk clubs in the 60s. And then gradually, as a lot of addicts do, she ended up pushing a lot of people away. So the song has a very particular resonance with her own story.
When I first came to town, they called me the Roving Jewel. Now they've changed their tune, call me Katie Krull. Where I would be, I
Katie Krull, the traditional Scottish song performed by Karen Dalton on her 1971 album In My Own Time. Clio Barnard, your most recent project, Sherwood, is a crime drama starring David Morrissey and Leslie Manville, inspired by real-life murders in Nottinghamshire in 2004. Was it a history you already knew about?
I didn't know that history. I knew Series 1, and I absolutely loved it because I loved James Graham's ability, really, to write something about the miners' strike that was absolutely gripping, had this huge popular appeal, but also politically tuned in. Quite often I have quite ambiguous feelings about whether to take on a project or not, but this one, it wasn't. I didn't have any ambiguous feelings. I was sure that I wanted to do it because I think he's a very brilliant writer and I'm very glad we have him.
The next music, I think, stems very much from your time in Yorkshire.
Yeah, I think maybe every soundtrack for everything that I've made. There's The Sound of Curlew, so I always sneak one in. Because I love them, and it just makes me feel very at home.
Well, we're going to segue, which I rather like doing straight from The Sounds of the Curlew, to a song, Sam Lee's song about curlews, called McCrimmon.
It's a really recent release. I really love Sam Lee. His previous album kind of got me through lockdown.
So a nice marriage of the actual and the remembered.
Yeah, it's true.
Will guide us. diagnosed you with late hour healing. All these old eyes can't see
We heard McCrimmon by Sam Lee from his 2024 album Song Dreaming, and before that we heard Simmered In, an album which contained those wonderful curlew sounds and the sheep baaing in the background. Clio, how do you come across new music for yourself, as it were, away from film? Is it serendipitously listening or what?
Sometimes it's serendipitous listening and kind of searching around and going down a rabbit hole, and a lot of the time it's friends, them sending me things or exchanging things. It feels like part of friendship is sharing music.
Your final piece came about like that.
Yeah, I have a good friend called Stuart Baker, and he developed a love of music and was a crate digger, I guess you'd call it, looking at vinyl. And he and his partner, Angela Scott, have a record shop and record label called Soul Jazz Records, Sounds of the Universe. And I've developed a love of, I'm sure it comes from my parents too, but of avant-garde or experimental jazz. And I absolutely love Alice Coltrane and this particular track. I just respond to it and love it. For me, sometimes that sort of music at its best, where it just moves you.
Yes, not knowing what it's about or what you should think about
it. Oh, what you should think. It just takes you somewhere.
It's named after Alice Coltrane's spiritual advisor, Swami Sachidananda, who I think helped Alice Coltrane through her grief after losing her husband, John Coltrane, to liver cancer in 1967.
Yeah, the one bit of knowledge I have about her is that he bought her a harp as a gift before he died, and it arrived after his death. And I can see that that loss and grief combined with that gift would take her on the journey that she then went on, that kind of gives us all this beautiful music.
Well, it only remains for me, Clio, to thank you very much for introducing us to all this music and indeed to your films.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been really gorgeous opportunity to sit and listen to music together, so thank you.
Journey in Satchidananda, composed and performed by Alice Coltrane on harp, with Pharaoh Sanders on soprano saxophone. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the film director and writer Cleo Barnard. Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael will be talking to the author Daniel Handler, better known under his pen name of Lemony Snicket, as the author of the 13-book saga, A Series of Unfortunate Events. That's Private Passions next Sunday at just after midday, here on Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms.
Start this year's festival with a bang.
Handel's Music for the Royal Fireworks kicks off the first night of the Proms here on BBC Radio 3. Then music by Bruckner, Clara Schumann, a new special BBC commission.
And finally, Beethoven, his Symphony No. 5.
The most incredible eruption of sounds here in the Royal Albert Hall.
The first night of the Proms.
Friday night from 6:30.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
This is Penny Gore with you for this Sunday on Radio 3. And choral evensong comes from Norwich Cathedral and the Organ Reborn Festival at 3 o'clock. Jazz Record Requests follows at 4, and in the early music show, Mark Seow looks ahead to the forthcoming Olympics, exploring sport in Baroque opera. Antonio Caldara's L'Olimpiada is set at the Games in ancient Greece, where the main characters seem just as interested in their love lives as excellence on the track. Just one setting of a text by the great librettist Metastasio. That's at 5 o'clock. But now at 1:30 on Radio 3, time to hand you over to Sarah Moorpeach for a 90-minute journey through music.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we work our way towards a single piece of music by way of sonic connections, creating a kind of Venn diagram for the ears. And today, we're heading for a high peak of musical ambition. This is Spem in Allium, a motet by the Elizabethan composer Thomas Tallis. It's written for a whopping 40 voices, each one of them singing a different distinct line of music. It is an extraordinary feat. And in this music, numbers matter. So for the first part of today's music map, we're going to play a counting game, a bit like Tallis, with music written for specific numbers of players, some of them multiples of a single instrument, others varied. And we're going to begin with the number 1.